thank you so much for the introduction. Sorry if you're a bit late, but I locked the door of my office 5 minutes ago. Perfect timing. I was planning to write down at least the title before. But okay, so you know the title, and I will start right away. So this will be a talk about Bootstrap, okay? And the idea is that we would like to understand what kind of constraints an effective field theory of quantum gravity must satisfy if we assume that the usual principle of unitarity, causality, and Lorentz invariance hold up to, you know, asymptotically at large energies. Okay? Well, this is the idea. Now, so let's start with an action, right? So the action of quantum gravity, at low energies, it is very simple to write down, okay? So there will be like the usual measure, okay? And then there is a bunch of terms, right? Like r, r square, r cube. Okay, let me go to r to the 4 and then I stop, dot, 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 okay? And you can think about this action, okay, as an action that is valid at scales that are much, much below than the Planck scale. So here I'm assuming that, for instance, I switch off all other interactions. All right, so I switched off all gauge interactions and so on, and I keep only the gravitational interaction turned on, okay? So therefore, the only scale that we have in this theory is L Planck, all right? So once we work in units of L Planck, this is completely a-dimensional. Okay. So the question that I'm going to ask, okay, is what kind of values this low energy Wilson coefficients that appear in front of higher dimensional operators, what kind of values are allowed? All right? And one simplification that I will make, because it's well, our starting point, is maximal SUSY. So in principle, for the method I'm going to describe, this is not necessary, but it's a huge simplification to run the numerics at the moment. Okay? So because of maximal SUSY, I can set C2 and C3 equal to 0, these two coefficients. So there is no R square interaction or R cube interaction, not allowed by supersymmetry. And the first non-universal term, okay? And by universal, I mean what I call universal is the leading Einstein-Hilbert term, okay? So general relativity for me is universal. What is universal is what are the corrections that appear later on, all right? So in the maximal supersymmetric case, this is the first correction, and I'm going to ask what are the allowed values for this coefficient alpha, okay? Now, alpha, how do we measure? So we have like this theory of quantum gravity. So what we can do is that we compute the S matrix, okay? We can compute the scattering amplitude and read off alpha from the scattering amplitude. And if you assume that the scattering amplitude satisfies the usual constraints of crossing, unitarity, and analyticity, then alpha must somehow fill these constraints in some way. So and this is what we are going to try to see, all right? And let me also add, so together with crossing unitarity analyticity, let me also add another property, which is polynomial boundedness, all right? So let me add the fact that if I go to infinitely large energies, I want to expect that the amplitude for physical value of the transfer momentum decays lower than S square, right? So this limit is equal to zero. So these are the assumptions that I'm going to make. All right. Now, again, what we did before, okay, this is something that we have already done, and what I'm going to talk today is about the continuation, okay? But what we already done is that we have studied the d equals to 10 case. So we look at 10 dimensions, and in a moment I will tell you why we look at 10 dimensions. And in the 10 dimensional case, we found that this coefficient alpha is bigger or equal than some alpha min that is equal to 0.13 plus minus 0.02, okay? Now, this number may not tell you much, okay, because I was planning to write something before on this blackboard. I didn't have time. But in both string theory, so we are in 10 dimensions, we have maximal supergravity, so one, you know, the UV completion we know is string theory, right? It's super string theory. So in 10 dimensions, both for type 2a and type 2b, this coefficient alpha is known, non-perturbatively, and it's given by something that is numerically 0.14, roughly, okay? So we found this nice coincidence that the allowed value of this coefficient alpha using these principles, okay, when we throw it in the bootstrap machine, we get a number that is an allowed region that is compatible with the string theory. So let me emphasize this alpha mean. Okay? String theory does not predict one value, but predicts a range of values. Okay? And this is because in both type 2a, type 2b, apart from L Planck, there is another scale in string theory, which is like L string. All right? So there is another dimensionful parameter, and the ratio is like some additional coupling, therefore you can tune this alpha mean. Okay? It cannot scan. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so this was like this is the intro of the talk, all right? So the question that I want to, continue in this direction, and I want to try to formulate a conjecture or ask a question. And the question is that whether string theory is the only UV completion of supergravity. Okay? So it's about asking if we can improve the precision about this number here, okay? Because right now in the error, it's, okay, it's compatible with 0.14, it's a little bit below, but it's compatible. So we want to increase the precision, and therefore I have to tell you a little bit how we do it, okay, to improve it. And then we want to test whether this coincidence still holds in other situations, in other cases where we have like analytic control, for instance, on the string theory side. All right? So what I'm going to do, so one, okay, this talk, what I plan to do is one, explain the bootstrap method a little bit and the way that we increase the precision on this number. And then I will show you results for d equals 9, 10, and 11. Okay? Because in all dimensions greater or equal than 8, this alpha is, is known also in lower dimensions, okay? But we checked it in 9 and 10 in these dimensions for a technical reason that maybe I will comment soon. All right? So what we did, this is what we did. And the idea is that, okay, if this coincidence keeps holding also in other dimensions where the numbers that string theory predicts are different, okay, then there is maybe something deeper behind, okay? We cannot prove it with the bootstrap, we can try to collect data. That's the idea. And then, of course, the third, you know, the next thing that we want to do is that we want to look at other corrections, right? Alpha to the 4 is the first correction, but in principle there are infinite of them, okay? So, you know, we have work for the life, but okay, so higher operators. But this is work in progress, so I don't have plot yet. Okay, so, but this is what we wanna do. All right? Okay. So, let me start now. Okay, so let me tell you more in detail what we are doing. So, the idea, as I anticipated, is the following, is to look at quantum gravity in a very convenient regime. So the first is d greater or equal than 5. I mean, there is a reason why I don't start directly from 4, right? Because 4 dimensions is like our world, and at least at low energies, right? And it's what we would like to study. But in dimensions smaller or equal than 5, you have infrared divergences. And when we have infrared divergences, maybe it's a technical problem, maybe not, we cannot run this bootstrap. Okay, because in principle with infinite divergences, all the non-perturbative properties I'm going to assume are even less clear. Okay? Even here, I'm talking about massless particles, so there are no rigorous theorems that tells that those properties are true. It's more physical intuition. All right? But if I have n equals 4, it's even worse situation. So I stay in d greater or equal than 5. And then again, as I told you before, it's like Max Susi. Okay? That simplifies his life a lot. So let me start with the maximal Susi. So when you have maximal Susi, on one end, we are not scattering any more gravitons, but we are scattering all the particles in the supermultiplet on one end. On the other end, we have supersymmetry that allows us to simplify a lot the scattering amplitude. So in the case of Max Susi, there is this magic that happens that the amplitude, okay, that I call, this, I denote here the super amplitude, okay? This is like the matrix that contains all the possible scattering states, okay? Between the particles in the super multiplet. So this super amplitude can be written as a universal factor that I call r to the 4, and then there is a scalar function, st nu. So you see, like there was like a tensor here, and the only dynamical structure that is important is this scalar function here, because all the kinematics, okay, all the dependence on the polarizations of these particles is contained in this prefactor, okay? So all the dynamics depend on one single function, and that's like the huge simplification of Susi. So just to give you an idea, like this r to the 4, so if I were to scatter, if I look at the component here where I scatter dilatons, for instance, this coefficient r to the 4 would be simply s to the 4 plus t to the 4 plus u to the 4, okay? Where s to u are the Mandelstam variables, just to say, right? If I were to scatter, for instance, what is called axidilaton, okay, this is like a charged object, then this would be just s to the 4, all right, and so on. So this is just like a decoration factor in front of the case of kinematics, and this is the object that we want to study that contains all the dynamics, okay? Now, what we know about this function here. So before, well, before listing the non-perturbative properties more in detail, let me tell you what we know perturbatively. When I mean perturbatively, I mean at low energy compared to L Planck. Okay? So at low energies, we know that this function of st nu behaves as, let me factorize here 8 pi g newton, so the coupling constant. Okay, so if I factorize the coupling constant, then this becomes just 1 over stu, okay, plus alpha d L Planck to the 6, okay, and then there will be some function, another universal function like this 1 over stu. Then in principle, there is this coefficient at order L Planck to the 10 with this structure here, okay. And, well, let me write it down. Order s to the d over 2 minus 4 L Planck to the d minus 2. Okay, order, higher orders. Okay? So this is how it looks at low energies. Now, how do I understand this structure, all right? So these first terms just comes from the Einstein-Hilbert interaction. Okay, it's just the scattering of gravitons in general relativity. So this is just due to this kind of diagrams. Okay, Born diagrams. Then this term here, okay, comes from this r to the 4 operator that we want to bound. So this would be really contact interaction with this r to the 4 operator here in the middle. And this universal function f1, it's just the box diagram, the one loop box diagram. Okay, the one loop correction due to graviton scattering. And then here in principle, this there will be like the insertion of the 4 r to the 4 operator, and so on. Right? So this is the kind of structure. Yes?
So
there is a dependence on dimensionality in this structure. Right? So the way I, well, first of all, this will depend on the dimension, this box diagram. Okay? So the way I ordered this expansion is valid for the say between 9 and 11, which is the case that I'm going to study, the case that we're considering this talk. If you were in lower dimensions, for instance, in d equals to 8, this loop box will mix with alpha d. We'll start to mix with this term, and then will become more important. Okay, so this kind of structure indeed depends on the dimension. And this is like the regime of validity. So here I'm, right, so you are thinking about the UV completion, babe, because here what I'm just looking is at the low energy, at the low energy action, okay? So the energy effective field theory, where I switched off all the gauge interactions in the standard model, say. Ah, diffeomorphism. No, but okay, right. But that's like a, that's related to the action, you know, to the, that's related like to the Lagrangian and so on. Here I'm talking about the S matrix. So the S matrix, by definition, should be gauge invariant, right? So when I compute scattering amplitude, that's a result of the experiment. Does not depend on the gauge that I chose to make the computations. In particular, this kind of structure is very rigid. It really depends just on unitarity and, well, okay, there is also supersymmetry, okay, that tells you what kind of terms can appear. No, that's true, that's true, but I'm not really doing the computation starting from the Lagrangian. So I'm telling you, those are the terms that appear in the Lagrangian. Then you fix the gauge, you do the computation, the answer you will get is this form, cannot have another form. That's what I'm saying. But yeah, in general, you know, yeah. Okay, so right, this is like just the physical answer for the amplitude. Okay, so okay, so this is the perturbative properties.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this loop. I mean, you can compute it perturbatively and worry about these problems, but you can also derive the same loop, just. If you want gluing together these three level amplitudes and run only the physical degree of freedom. Okay, maybe like soon I will talk about this tensor structure. So maybe let's, in a second, let's talk more about this in a second. Okay, so you, okay. So this is like perturbation theory at the moment. So now let me, let me answer your question now basically, okay? Because now we have to talk about the non-perturbative properties of this amplitude. All right, so let me erase this. For instance, let's start with crossing, because crossing is easy. Right? So you take care of crossing just by the fact that this function is like crossing symmetric in these variables, like perturbation invariance under S, T, and U. So crossing is easy, and we are going to assume that this is true, even for this function non-perturbatively. Okay? And the other is unitarity. Now, indeed, unitarity is related to your question about what stuff can flow inside the loop that is true. Okay? So, unitarity, indeed, for this super amplitude. Okay, let's write it down for the super amplitude, okay? So unitarity in the S channel, for instance, okay, is given by this form, that the imaginary part or the discontinuity of this super amplitude is given by an integral over the invariant phase space, okay? This is kinematics. And then there is a sum over the SUSY particles that run in the loop. And then you have A222 times A star. Hmm? So So this is like a unitary equation. It's continuum of the amplitude is given by the product of these two amplitudes, as you said, right? They like glue together and then stuff run in the loop. Now, there is a trick here, which is called, goes by the name of duplication formula. Which is true when you have like maximal SUSY, but I'm not sure how it modifies when you have less SUSY. That's an exercise I never tried, but when you have maximal SUSY, the sum over all the SUSY particles of this R to the 4 coefficient, this R to the 4 tensor, is equal to S to the 4 times R to the 4. That's why it's called duplication formula. Okay, you multiply these two tensors, the only thing that happens is that you reproduce the same tensor times a factor S to the 4. Okay? For this reason, okay, if I plug this expression here, you see right away that unitarity, we can factor out the R to the 4 coefficient out of the unitarity equation, and you get just the imaginary part in this channel of this function, A of S T N U, is equal to the integral over the invariant phase space, which is kinematics. And the only thing that you have is like this S to the 4 factor, and then there is this function A times A star. Okay? So unitarity for the superamplitude, that in principle is very complicated, it involves all this tensor structure, because of this magic due to supersymmetry, just simplifies into a scalar equation. Okay, where we have the usual discontinuity of the amplitude given by the product of the two amplitude, okay? With an extra factor S to the 4. And actually, this extra factor S to the 4 is important because this is not standard unitarity. Okay, it's not the standard unitarity. So, does this more or less answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, because of this factor, what is happening is that the component that satisfies unitarity is not this function A, but it's more like a function that I call T, STNU, which is S to the 4 times A. All right? So this may seem a little, a small thing, but you see this A is crossing symmetric, but unitarity acts diagonally on a function that is not crossing symmetric anymore. So there is a little bit of twist between unitarity and crossing in this case, all right? And also let me notice that this component T is not necessarily a physical, it's not necessarily a physical amplitude, okay? Because it depends a little bit on what kind of UV completion I have in mind. In the sense that this would like be a natural component for when you scatter oxydilatons, for instance, okay? But we don't have oxydilaton in all supersymmetric theory of gravity, all right? So it's not necessarily a physical component, but it's the one that enters unitarity, right? Okay, so this is about unitarity and crossing. Now let me discuss a little bit the last property, which is analyticity. Okay, so to play any analytic game, we need to discuss analyticity. And analyticity, we are going to assume what is called the maximal analyticity, which is, just means that the scattering amplitude is analytic everywhere except for the cuts that are determined by the physical scattering. Okay? What I mean by that? Well, let me draw a diagram. Okay, so let me fix t equal to 0, for instance. If I fix t equal to 0, then in the S-plane, this amplitude is supposed to be analytic away from the cuts, and where the cuts start? The cuts start where this equation has support, right? The question does that discontinuity, the amplitude starts when you can basically flow inside here on shell states, okay? Which basically means that only for S greater or equal than 0. Because you have massless particles, so the threshold is 0. You can scatter, you have like physical states right from S equal to 0, and therefore for S positive, there is a cut. This is the S channel structure, so this is like unitarity. Then we have crossing, right? So crossing, tells you that, well, if we look in the, we're at fixed t. So if you look the amplitude in the U channel, which means at t equal to 0, it means U equals minus S, the amplitude is the same. Okay, so there will be a cut also here because of crossing. And in particular, the amplitude here will be equal to the amplitude here. Hopla. Okay? And then how we continue on top of the cut? We continue on top of the cut using another property that I haven't listed, which is called real analyticity, and is related to time reversal invariance that I'm going to assume. Okay, so real analyticity just tells you that on the other side of the cut, the amplitude is the complex conjugate. Okay, I will leave. And with this continuation, we can continue the amplitude in the whole cut plane. Okay, because we know that here there is A star, and here there will be A star also. Right? So this is an analytic structure. And again, analyticity is the statement that everywhere outside of, you know, away from this cut, this function is analytic. And the same goes like if we start to move t. Okay? T away from the real axis also keeps analyticity intact. Okay? Okay. So now, what about at infinity? So what happens when we go to large S? Yes, please. So, let's say that in the massless case, it's an assumption. In the massless case, it's an assumption. Yeah. We don't know counterexamples, but of course, we know only how to compute stuff in perturbation theory. And we also believe that. For instance, gravity on theories that resemble gravity at low energies. When you go at large impact parameters, so it means also, you know, large energy, right? For instance, large spin, low energy. Okay, we also assume that it's semi-classical in that case. And if it's semi-classical, okay, there are no singularities again. So, yeah, in the gapped case, analyticity can be proven. Almost, it can, maximum analyticity can be almost proven in the gapped case. But even in the gapped case, there are some restrictions. So, but in the massless case, it's assumptions. Yeah.
Are you, you're assuming crossing symmetry when you write down this ASTU?
I believe that here I'm also assuming crossing symmetry. For the same reason.
So when you're building it
at
the
start before you do this? Yeah. And
like examples from string theory,
scanning
amplitudes, can you prove that there's like proper
cross symmetry? Starting from string theory, I think that yes, because you have kind, I mean, you know, starting from correlators, you have kind of LSZ, so at the end of the day, you end up into a crossing symmetric. Crossing symmetric amplitudes. Now, prove it depends. What you mean by prove it, right? It's like a more or less rigorous. But if you have like string theory, you know, if you know the UV completion, then you can try to argue from your computation that everything goes through, no? That nothing bad happens. Because even in QFT, you start from, you know, crossing symmetry, you start from the T product inside the Green's functions, right? You start from correlators and then through LSZ, you see that, you know, the correlators you can basically, you know, you can switch them. Okay, there is like some manifest crossing invariance from the correlator, and then when you go through LSZ, everything is preserved. Okay, no, okay. Maybe I was too fast, but. Yeah, crossing, it's also an assumption. Okay. Okay, so, yeah. So what I want to, so what I care now is like few, what time is it? Okay. Few words about S goes that goes to infinity, okay, to the boundary. So what can we say? So we can combine unitarity together with the regge boundedness, okay, to this property the amplitude is bounded, it cannot grow faster than S square. Okay, so we combine the two, So we combine the fact that when s goes to infinity, t for t negative, okay, this is equal to zero. Therefore, I write an inequality. I can put an s to the fourth factor here, divided by s squared, and this still has to be equal to zero. So because of unitarity, this function a, okay, this stripped function here, must decay faster than, faster than a constant, for sure, at infinity. So the claim here is that the amplitude decays at infinity, goes to zero. Right? Now, this property is important, okay? It's important, it allows us to derive an analytic bound on alpha from below. Okay, so let me do this derivation here. So let me erase here. Right, so this is related to the, so this is the usual, so first of all, this is the usual statement of polynomial boundedness. Okay, so you don't want like essential singularities at infinity. Now, we can discuss about the number of subtractions, the precise behavior that we want at infinity. Now, this power 2, it really matches this semi-classical intuition that when you are at low energy, at large spin, for instance, when you go like asymptotically in the impact parameter plane, then the amplitude behaves classically. And the classical amplitude satisfies this property. That's the reason why we want to assume this. And this is a concept, this function a decays. Now, if this function a decays, we can derive a lower bound on alpha, on this coefficient alpha. Okay, so let's do it. So because this amplitude decays, actually, we can consider a function a to idle, which is a minus 1 over stu. Okay, we can just subtract 1 over stu from this function. If we do so, then the imaginary part of this function a to idle is the same as the function a, and then this function a to idle has the same analyticity properties. Okay, I'm just subtracting a real piece from this function. Now, why I do this subtraction? I do this subtraction because I want to write this special relation for alpha, for this coefficient, all right? So you see alpha basically is this coefficient here. What I'm doing is that I'm subtracting this term from the amplitude, okay? So then if I subtract 1 over stu, I can write alpha as the residue at the origin, basically. Okay, I can pick it up with the residue theorem. So let me write this special relation. So let me consider this contour, okay, that I can blow up, and then if I blow it up, I get this, the integral over this big contour, all right? And therefore, because of analyticity, the integral of over this small contour of the amplitude, let me take a divided by s, okay? So let me say I take a at equal to zero, I divide by s, integrate with this pole, okay? This is equal to zero. But then when I blow up, of course, okay, this becomes 1 over 2 pi I, the integral from minus infinity to minus epsilon. Okay, so this is epsilon, this is minus epsilon, right? Plus the integral from epsilon to infinity. Then we have this function, okay, sorry, this was a to idle from the start. This function a to idle of s t equal to zero divided by s in s. And this has to be equal to the, minus the contribution that comes from this integral here at the origin, right? So this is just, how do I call it, C epsilon? This minus C epsilon, okay, is this small contour here. So I have C epsilon, a to idle ds times ds, okay? Now, this integral, of course, this is 1 over 2 pi I here, okay? So the integral, alpha d by definition is the residue at zero of this function when we strip this pole here. So this will give me alpha. right way. And the sum of this contribution, okay, if I use using crossing basically, so here I can basically replace s by minus s, nothing changes. And then this, the difference between these two integrals picks the discontinuity of this function here. Okay, it's the usual trick where this basically becomes the lower part here, so you pick the discontinuity. So all in all, I skip some detail, but I gave you the idea. So this alpha d is given by 2 over pi integral from 0 to infinity in s of the imaginary part of a twiddle, which is the same as the imaginary part of the original function, divided by s. Okay? And this is positive. Why this is positive? Because the imaginary part of the amplitude in the forward direction is positive, okay? Because it's the cross section, if you want. Okay? We can prove it in many ways, but the amplitude in the forward direction is positive. So therefore, this alpha is positive. So now, with the in the remaining 10 minutes, I will explain what we can do to improve this zero, this bound zero, and I will show you the plots. Okay? So what we want to do with the bootstrap is that, okay, this is the analytic argument, but of course this only uses very little. It only uses the fact that the imaginary part is positive. But we know that in the amplitude there is a real part, all right? We know that this amplitude A contains also this 1 over stu factor, which is the gravitational interaction. So the fact that there is like a gravitational interaction that we cannot turn off, it's what will basically improve this bound from zero to be some finite number. Okay, so it's really this this guy here. Now, to see more intuitively why this happens, let me let me tell you how we formulate the bootstrap problem. Okay, so then you will see the constraints more in detail, and you will also understand why this will push the bound up. Okay, so okay, let me erase here. I will write down something similar soon. Okay. So this now becomes a math problem, right? Assuming all these properties for the amplitude, we want to find the minimum value of alpha once we vary in the space of this function. Okay, so this is like a math problem. We want to minimize alpha d. Okay. And we will use what is called the primal approach. Okay, for some reasons. And the algorithm is very simple. We write down a crossing and analytic ansatz for the amplitude. Okay? And we will impose unitarity numerically. So this will be automatically satisfied. This will be imposed numerically. All right? And then varying, imposing unitarity numerically and varying in the space of functions that are crossing and analytic, we will minimize this coefficient alpha. Okay? This is the idea. So now let me tell you about one. All right? So for one, we write an ansatz for the amplitude, so an ansatz for the non-perturbative amplitude, okay? So for the UV completion of supergravity, if you want. And this ansatz starts with 1 over stu, okay, which is the universal graviton term, graviton interaction. And then we write down, let me write it, okay, I can be more or less precise, but formally, this is the form of the ansatz. Okay, so we have like a Taylor series with some coefficients that are permutation invariant under these labels, and then I have like rho s to the n, rho t to the n, rho u to the np. Right? So, if these coefficients are crossing symmetric, this function is crossing symmetric, so crossing is okay. The second property is analyticity, so I have to tell you what is the expression for this map rho. So this map rho is simply given by 1 minus square root of minus s divided by 1 plus square root of minus s, which is the map that takes the complex plane without the cut, and it maps it in this way to the unit disk. So it takes this Pacman contour, and it maps it to the unit disk. where, for instance, you can see this is s equal to 0, is at 1, then here there is infinity, here there is minus 1, and this is the real axis. So it's 1 plus I epsilon, this is 1 minus I epsilon. Okay, so the cut is opened up, and the cut is mapped to the boundary of the circle. So this is the map. And this map automatically takes care of this maximal analyticity, in the sense that this Taylor series stops converging when you hit this singularity here. Okay? So this is the ansatz. And now we need to impose unitarity. Okay? To impose unitarity, we basically project into partial waves. Okay? So meaning that instead of defining the amplitude as a scattering eigenstates of the momentum, I define the amplitude as scattering eigenstates of the angular momentum, okay, with some fixed spin. So I have two particles, okay, that with some fixed spin. Right? And the way to write down this this partial wave is just to basically sum 1 plus, there is some factor, okay? So this is like in equals 10, for instance. I can write it too explicitly. It's just this, which is basically just is a phase space factor. It's like units of momentum times the volume of the sphere, roughly. Then there is this integral, where this is also related to this sphere at infinity. And then there is s to the 4, our function a, ansatz, okay, so this function here, we plug it in this integral, and we integrate in z, okay. So this function here has the nice property that behaves as a probability, because unitarity, when we go to this base, become diagonally, so we can just impose that SL square is smaller or equal than 1, right? Another way to write it down, actually, so let me call this integral here FL, which is the usual notation for the partial amplitudes. So another way to write down unitarity is to say that the two times the imaginary part of FL, that is more familiar, it's what I wrote before, must be greater or equal than the absolute value of FL square. Mm? And now you see why the Gravidon pole is important. Because if we just use positivity, then okay, positivity, okay, this is absolute value, so this is positive, fine. So this is zero, okay? But nonlinear unitarity knows only about the real parts of the partial waves, okay? And the real parts of partial waves are non-zero because our amplitude scatters graviton, okay? We are not sending G Newton to zero. We are not at L Planck to, you know, yeah, it's not zero L Planck. It's different from zero in this setup. Therefore, we can never hit zero, but this must be, you know, some non-trivial number, okay? So this is the intuition. Okay? And now, before showing the plots, okay, I still have 5 minutes for the plots, let me tell you about a bit more about this numerical setup, all right? So, as you can see, there is like a cutoff n here, in the sense that fn goes to infinity, we span over all possible analytic functions, but we have to keep n finite because we want to, you know, use a computer for this. And the second cutoff is that we have to impose unitarity, one of these two conditions. We have to impose it for any spin and for any physical energy, which is like another infinite number of constraints. So what we have to do in our numerics is that we have to also choose some cutoff L where we impose spin. And L can be 100, 200, you know, and this is like typical numbers that we use, like, and then you keep improving, okay? And the idea is that first you take the limit L that goes to infinity, okay, at fixed n. So you fix some n, and you send the number of constraints to infinity so that you are sure that your function satisfies all the constraints, and then you keep, you know, you try to send n to infinity afterwards, okay? So in this way, your ansatz at each fixed n satisfies all the constraints. And you little by little span the space of all possible analytic functions. That's how we reach the minimum for this alpha. Okay, we travel in the space of analytic functions until we find the minimum values, but keeping the constraints. Okay? Now, as you can see, I mean, as you will see soon in the plots, this constraint, I mean, the fact that we have a cutoff here that we want to send to infinity is very crucial for these numerics, in the sense that our results are very sensitive to this cell, and this cell has to be very huge to make sure that the numbers don't move anymore, okay? That we trust convergence of this algorithm. So one idea that can be, that I want to explain before showing the plots, is that we can supplement positivity with some orthogonal constraints. Okay, so I will tell you in a moment what I mean by orthogonal constraints. Okay, so because of our numerical cutoff that we bound all the spin up to L, what we are doing is that we are only bounding the imaginary part to be positive for any L smaller than L. Okay, but positivity, which is like a simple condition to impose, should be held for L. So what we can do, instead of using the angular momentum basis, we can go back to the momentum basis and use positivity for the amplitude. What I mean by that? Okay, so let me tell you what I mean. I mean the following, that unitarity as a matrix, no, can be written in the following form. So this is like the S matrix, so 1 minus SS dagger is semi-definite positive, it's like an operator condition. Mm? Now, if I split S to be 1 plus IT, okay, this implies that in particular, okay, among the things that implies that the imaginary part of this operator T must be semi-definite positive. Mm? Now, again, if I project this operator on a basis of eigenstates of the angular momentum, I get this diagonal condition that the scalar functions are all positive. But another thing that I can do is that I can project on eigenstates of the momentum, all right? Which means that I consider like momentum on the celestial sphere, in a way. Okay, so to explain what I mean, so imagine, for instance, that I choose a basis of states that I call, 1, 2, and 3, okay? And these states are simple two-particle states because we are scattering particles, okay? So we project this operator on two-particle states. These two-particle states are, for instance, this is 1, okay? This is 2, okay? This pair of momentum, and this is 3. Now, I draw them like this because I imagine to scatter particles in the center of mass. So in the center of mass, these vectors have the same length, which is square root of s divided by 2. Okay, and they are basically on a straight line. Okay, and let me call these angles, this is theta, this is theta prime, this is theta second. Mm? Now, when I project the imaginary part of the amplitude on this basis of states, okay, what I will get a matrix, right? So let me say this is 1, 2, 3, this is 1, 2, 3, okay? Then I get a 3 by 3 matrix. And here, okay, I have to put the, well, I get the imaginary part of the amplitude when I basically bracket with, basically with these states. So for instance, in the first element, I have in the initial state this particle in this direction, and in the final state, the same particle in the same direction. Okay, so what I get here is the imaginary part of the amplitude in the forward direction. Okay, so this is like the cosine theta of the angle. Okay, so it's the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. Hmm? It's clear so far? Maybe a bit too fast, but please stop me if it's not clear. Okay, but when I consider the same state, then I get the amplitude of the forward direction, right? Because it's the same state in the initial and in the final state. But then when I bracket different state, all right, I take the amplitude. Defined at the cosine of the angle between the two different states, all right? And so on. Here I get like imaginary part of S and cosine between particle 1 and 3, which is theta second, okay? And here there will be again 1 because the diagonal are forward, okay? And here I get the imaginary part of some other angle, cosine theta. And this matrix must be like semi-definite positive, which means semi-definite positiveness means that you have to take all the principal minors of this matrix and impose that they are positive. Okay? So in particular, the elements of the diagonal are positive, so the imaginary part in the forward direction is positive. But then you get all sorts of conditions also considering by 2x2 matrices. And these are like nonlinear constraints of the amplitude that go beyond positivity in the imaginary direction. Okay? So if you want, the picture is the following. We impose the imaginary part of the partial wave, so we cover one part of the constraints. By imposing that this kind of matrices are semi-definite positive, we cover another part of the spin constraints. They are redundant because there is an overlap, but using both this and the positivity of the, well, not the positivity, but full unitarity, okay, up to some cutoff, we basically cover like more constraints. So that's the basic idea. So we use like two bases that are different to impose more constraints. That's the idea. So if there are questions now, otherwise I will show you some plots with the results. Okay, if there are no questions, hello? Okay, so let me show you the numerical results, all right? So these were the, so these were our old data, all right? So as you say, this is like the bound, so as we said, like this is the bound of, on alpha, so the minimum value of alpha in 10 dimensions. And here you can see all the data that we collected. So as a function of the spin, for instance. So this minimum value, you see it's like monotonic increasing because as we increase the number of spins, okay, for any fixed n, so for any fixed color, we increase the number of spins, so the minimum value goes up because we increase the number of constraints. Then, of course, if we increase the number of terms inside our ansatz, the minimum value goes down. So what we want to be sure every time is that we are in this asymptotic region, okay, that this value of alpha for each n reaches some plateau, doesn't move anymore as we increase the number of constraints, okay? And then with some adventurous extrapolation, in our previous paper, we found this number here that matched with the string theory. Okay, this was like the adventurous extrapolation. Okay, now we have like a better data. So with this like positivity condition that I described, that we impose this matrix that are semi-definite positive, okay, that just depend on the angle of the celestial sphere. What we can do is that we can basically consider random vectors on the sphere, or maybe random vectors concentrated in some very interesting spot, like around the forward direction. And here you see the effect on the bound. Okay? So this again is like the minimum of alpha as a function of the spin for one particular value of n. And you see, this is like the behavior that you get when you do not impose this positivity in the sky, as we called it. And this is what happens when we impose these additional conditions. So you see that like it's like a huge jump. So instead of going to spin 200 to find some plateau, we can stop at spin 60, say, and still find the plateau. So this was like the technological jump, okay? And with this jump, we were able to reach values of n that are much, 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 much larger, okay? So for instance, in 10 dimensions, what was before an adventurous extrapolation, now, well, we almost, you know, we almost became asymptotic with this value of n, okay? And, okay, so this is like basically the main result of our last paper, okay? This bunch of data for 9, 10, and 11 dimensions, all right? So these are all these nice data, and how they compare with string theory? I guess this is like the result, okay? So we find something, right, we find something maybe expected, maybe not, I don't know, but the bootstrap values that we get, now the precision is much higher, and there is a little gap with the string tier, in the sense that the bootstrap bound goes a little bit below, meaning that string theory, at least when we look at this one observable, all right? Okay, when I say string theory, it's like this observable in string theory, is in the allowed region, which is good. While for M theory, it's on the boundary at the moment, okay? So, okay, now the kind of question that one can keep asking, okay, to understand what's going on is that if whether this gap is compatible with other UV completions, if there is like other UV completions of supergravity in between these two numbers, or if this gap is, for instance, due to particle production. Because in this bootstrap approach, I always talk about 2-2-2 scattering amplitudes. I never talk about 2-2n. But in principle, all those processes appear, and they should give like additional constraints. All right? And well, another comment that I want to make is that M theory, as I said, is on the boundary of the allowed region. But in principle, in M, I mean, if the UV completion is M theory, then in M theory there is no scale. In a sense, the only scale is L Planck. Sorry, there is no coupling. The only scale is L Planck, and everything is fixed in units of L Planck. Okay? So this should be like a fixed number. It shouldn't allow for a region. So we found the region. This is a bit to understand. Okay? But now let me tell you something else that we can do with Bootstrap, because once we minimize this parameter alpha, we also reconstruct the extremal amplitude in the sense that we minimize alpha and we get the function that realizes this minimum. Okay, so we get some function that looks like an unperturbative string theory amplitude, if you want. Why I say so? Well, I say so because we can look at the extremal amplitude of the complex plane and we can look for particles. So we can do like particle hunting in these ansatz. Okay, look at the resonances. So here, for instance, is like the spin 0 and the spin 2 complex planes. Okay, so you see all these basically black regions are the zeros where the function is 0. Okay, so you see when you see something that is close to the real axis, well, it's what like Fino people would call it a resonance. All right, so this is like a particle for us. Okay, and then in the higher spins, there are other particles. Because you see this huge black dot, there is some spin to resonance and so on. So we can find all these zeros, we can collect them, and we can put them in a plane, okay? We can put them, we can plot them as a function of the spin and the mass. And what you observe is that we observe some nice, I would call them range trajectories, okay? Which suggest that indeed this amplitude that we find looks stringy, okay? And but they are a bit curved. So they're not linear, but they are curved. Like if you try to, well, this is not the error. This is just the width of this resonance, so how much imaginary they are. So the errors are very small. So you can fit with high precision this data. You see the coefficient is not one, but it's some power. Okay? So, and then what else can we learn about this extremal amplitude? Another thing that we can learn is that this amplitude, it really looks like the amplitude of a weakly coupled effective field theory. So how we say so? So how we like, you know, how we make this claim? Well, we look at the cross section again. So we look at the imaginary part on the forward direction. So for instance, this is the integrand that gives the value of alpha. So the alpha mean that we proved before. So if we integrate, this integrand is positive. And now you see how it looks like as a function of S. And you see that in this region here, close to the threshold, so different curves correspond to different n. So our numerics improve as we go from lighter to darker. Well, there is not light and dark, but okay. As we go from here to here, our numerics improve. Red is the best value we have. And we see that in the region, this function plateau. And this plateau here, these dashed lines, are given by the one-loop graviton contribution that I wrote you before. It's the universal one-loop gravitational interaction. So you expect that for energy smaller than L Planck, okay, so you have units in L Planck, so for energy smaller than one in units of L Planck, this should like go to a plateau, which is the effective field theory plateau, okay? Then spin zero, I think I finished, so spin zero dominance, I don't want to comment. Then here, I just want to say one thing that, we don't have time to comment this. I want to say that particle production, so one way to explain this gap between string theory and the bound that we find in the bootstrap is, for instance, to consider particle production. And one possible source of particle production that we have in graphs is the production of black holes, okay? So it can be proven analytically that as soon as you have like some particle production, the value of alpha should be pushed up, okay? So one possible explanation is an effect that you want to study is like to input some model for black hole production and see how our bound change, okay? And I will conclude here, okay? So the plan now at the moment is like to look at higher dimensional operators, so to see if this coincidence between string theory and and bounds on these observables just from consistency of the scattering agree, also for higher dimensional operators, because alpha is just one number. But if we turn on the other corrections, we would start to get like some nice regions like this. Okay? So our bootstrap bounds, if they would cover this region, it would be like a much more non-trivial check. That there is something deeper, maybe, right? So this is like alpha, this is like beta, for instance. Okay, so if you turn on the next coefficient, that's what you would expect from string theory. And then we can go to lower dimensions, where there are no string, well, I wouldn't say no. Okay, there are some string theory predictions, but not that we know right away. Okay, look for other UV completions, then including black hole to check this discrepancy, and the dream would be to scatter gravitons with no supersymmetry in equals to 5. That would be the dream, but that's still like we have some work to do before getting there, and I will stop here. Okay? So, thanks.
Okay, if there is no more questions, let's end our
session. Okay, thanks.